Francis Hunt, the market sniper himself. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Absolute pleasure. Glad to be back, Tom.
So Francis, with so much going on right now, I don't really know where to start, to be honest, today. I feel like the overarching theme that I am constantly kind of seeing and getting the feeling of, more so, let's say, is that this war and this, let's say, era right now is far more about energy, access to energy, and also really an inflation story, a broader inflation story right now. So, you know, there's all of the infrastructure, obviously, that was damaged in the Middle East around oil and gas, but there's also the infrastructure being damaged in Russia's largest Baltic export hub. And there was also an explosion recently in the US, which, you know, we don't want to say was caused by anybody deliberately, but seeing all of these different pieces of energy infrastructure getting damaged right now, I feel like that's kind of hard to escape right now. And I think that all and also plays into this larger inflation story. Do you get that same sense right now?
Yes. I mean, previously we've said, and we take this up to the highest level, this is debt and fiat debasement. Mm-hmm. They needed inflation, and we were in an essential recession. Many people saying, you know, the Fed's going to be behind the curve in cutting, and we're going, no, you're not going to get the cuts you think you're going to go. It's higher for longer, pullbacks will be much shorter, and you go higher. And the reason for that is there's an excess of debt, and people don't want it anymore. And just on that point, you've had the long-term debt has been already very high in rates for quite some time. And you've watched that come down the short end now. You've gone from 20 years, 30 years, and 10 years getting dicily high to now recently the threes, twos, and ones. There was a terrible auction on the twos. The primary dealers had to hold a large part of the issuance. So what we have is a real issue. The debt thing is causing a problem. They need the stagflation, and we need an extreme version of that, which is why we've always modeled for hyperstagflation. We sort of adopted the phrase, and we've made it one of our core thumbnails. Mm-hmm. And I'll share that. We do some screen share just to get some visuals as well going. People like that, and I'll share it as well. But part of what stagflation is, they need stagflation for a couple of reasons. So let's handle the stagflation. And the hyper version thereof. So you had stagflation in the 70s. We've got a far more extreme version that is needed now. It's basically where economic growth collapses. It's very low, flat, or even negative, whilst inflation and currency debasement remains stubbornly high and is severely eroding household purchasing power. They need to engineer that economic environment. So whilst we were in the recessional moment that nobody agreed was a recession, except we did when they had first met the criteria, we called nonsense on Biden's DEI hires, the labor numbers, the whole truth came out on non-farm payrolls, the overstatement. We said we called that lie on unemployment and the strength of the economy, that Yellen said it can't be a recession because, you know, the employment numbers are so great. Well, that's clearly been shown to be a lie. And we said the next lie is the CPI. The CPI is a lie. And they've been telling you that the CPI is in the 2.5 range, and that's pure propaganda, but they've needed to revert back to truth, much like the mainstream media have slowly released articles that suddenly tend to be pointing to the truth regarding CV19, because the mainstream media stopped getting followed whilst they were adhering to the grand lie, and that you have to, I think it was Martin Luther King that said, you know, the long arch of justice eventually reverts towards truth, and they have to keep bringing it back. And the CPI is the lie, and we said that they're going to have to find an event where they can reset to a much higher level and also get further of it to bring the stagnation, to get deflation to join the stagnation. We've got the stagnation in the economic growth, and this is the model. This is what happened in the 70s. By the way, OPEC was the reason last time, and that came with the petrodollar. So Kissinger established the petrodollar. They gave those that power to the Arabian states and said also, by the way, form a cartel and push the prices up. The notion that that was all not with America's blessing. You know, everybody said, that's terrible. These guys are profiteering and all of that. But they needed that because they needed to debase the debt that Nixon and previous presidents from Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Nixon had raised during the Vietnam War. America had overexpended, and that's when France called BS on the gold backing. So they were cheating. They were printing more dollar notes than they actually had gold, and they got caught on it. So they always commit fraud, typically, and more fraud will be exposed. And OPEC served as, okay, they created the inflation. We can blame it on the Arabs. They did that. They pushed the oil price up. And we just did a video. Oil prices are essentially a financial weapon of mass destruction, dressed up as a commodity in a military uniform. You know, so oil is much more than just a commodity. It's how the Rockefeller tax comes in and skims big and inflicts poverty onto the masses. So when you have excess debt and fiat that you've created, that you've benefited from all the pumps, and now you need the dump to be carried and socialized by the masses, what you actually do is you engineer inflation once you've already got weak economic growth, and you get the exact opposite of the Goldilocks economy of Greenspan, where we had globalization, low prices, huge assets increasing from housing.com, you name it. You now get the night where you get asset corrections, much higher interest rates. We're also going to have austerity, governments reneging on the social contract. So we're talking about a fall in real wages, rising commodity prices, widespread financial distress. It sounds like we're the doomer of all doomers, but you've got to remember, you had the boom of all booms on the other side with the Goldilocks economy. And that was part of the buildup of the debt into dot-com, subprime, CV19. And it's the same people every time that do the irresponsible borrowing. They borrow, they push asset prices up, they profit from it, and then they socialize the cost through stagflation. That's why we always said this ends in an extreme version of stagflation. You're waiting for the inflation part to join the recessionary part to get the stagflation. That brings us why we are. Look, other agendas are being pursued by the oil. So oil leads into plastic. It leads into shipping rates. There's no insurance now, so they charge a bunch more. Shippers are going to be making profits. But the masses, the larger masses are going to be paying way more at the tills. By the way, Tom, I pointed out that Walmart's gone digital price tags in as a monopoly or oligopoly, we should probably say, in the retail world of America. And that's going to lead to central real-time price changes on goods in the supermarket. So much so that you could actually have put something in your basket, and by the time you check out, possibly the price could have already gone up. So why would you do that? Well, some people will explain it away as, well, it's technology, it's progress. You don't need a guy with a ticker going around and stamping all the goods. Yeah, but why that progress right now? You know, why that progress right now? Real-time movements in prices is going to be a very, very abrupt. And it's in the plastic, it's in the packaging, it's in the delivery, it's in the goods itself, it's in everything. It's in the fertilizer that's going to cost more for that grows the wheat that leads to the bread loaf that you're buying that has the plastic on it, that has to be delivered, etc., etc., etc. So the knock-on and these little nudges of the digital pricing are all proof that what we've been expecting, a next wave of inflation that takes us deep into stagflation, into almost a hyperversion, is now here. And they needed to do this. And that's how, not for our benefit, certainly, it's at our cost, but that's how they manage the downside, typically. And they sit in the assets that will rebase up, and you'll sit in with the debt, you'll sit with the higher cost of living and negative real wages. So let me hand back to you.
Well, Francis, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned those the changing digital price tags. And of course, you know, it exists in the world that there are channels that have proven that these price changes happen when you walk into the store, and based around your shopping habits and stuff like that. So this isn't just Francis being, you know, Mr. Conspiracy Guy. But to your other point about the fertilizer, you know, we've seen China actually stop exports completely to the US for fertilizer. There are US fertilizer suppliers that aren't even quoting being able to price fertilizer right now. And of course, that is all going to lead into not only inflation in food prices, but also shortages in food, right?
Oh, 100%. And there's even ships that are setting out to Europe that are changing course. So it's been alleged that contractually the Asians will just outbid. You say, you've got that on the water, just reroute it. We'll pay you extra cost and plus, you know, 20%, 25%. And if you're the commodity originator, you know, you'll take whatever breach of contract that might mean and say, sorry, maybe we'll get you next time. If they get too rude with you, say, well, we won't supply you anymore at all. So you tend to hold all the cards once you own and hold all the key goods. And when in a debasement hyperstagflationary era, expect the inverse. So we spoke about the, you know, the curve that we call the Ernest Hemingway curve. Slowly at first, this is the dollar's loss of value. And then suddenly very fast. That is that curve that has got that convexity and then accelerates. That's the debasement of debt and fiat. And it's going to be suddenly come harsh, fast and brutal. And they're going to show it to you in the cost of goods going up. They're going to blame it all and confuse everybody and saying, well, it's the cost of removing the nuclear threat of Iran, you know, the smokescreen of that. But in actual fact, you're paying the cost for the excessive fiat that was created in the debt markets. There's about 300 plus trillion in the world. And you're looking at America with 134 when you take the unfunded liability. So they're going to renege. They can't pay. And they're facing higher interest rates. So while some people think this is 5D chess and a masterclass, because America is slightly more energy independent and does some small export, the long run is it's a short-term tactical move. It's not strategic. It just causes inflation for everyone. And all the nations are actually synchronized to inflict this poverty on all the mass citizenry and all those that are of the master class. The supremacists are going to be benefiting and are well positioned. We don't have real justice. I mean, the amount of contracts that got bought and shorted on the oil when Trump announced his phony story around having a chat with Iran. I mean, this just shows to you there's insider trading. No one's going to get brought to book. This is a cacocracy. It's end of empire where everyone is literally stripping the lights off the walls in the old Grand Hotel. This is the debauchery. This is the looting phase of end of empire, as far as I'm concerned, Tom.
Francis, you know, you mentioned the Hemingway type curve, which is, let's say, an inverse or a negative exponential curve. How does that actually look, let's say, on the long end of the yield curve right now? You know, we've seen yields kind of start to really increase. So you mentioned that this is a debt issue, especially for the US. The euro would be the same. There's all these countries that have the same debt problem that all have to do the same type of thing. So how is that showing up in the yield curve in the US right now? And we can just stay with the US.
So just staying with the US, when you're talking about debt debasement, there's two ways that you debt debase. In fact, we have a diagram for that as well. I don't think I'll find it fast enough to show you, but we've got this sort of geyser that is heating with a fire under it and a sort of clock that's going into the red zone that wants to explode. And you can release some of the pressure on two taps. One is you let the rates go up and the value of the debt go down. So we've had that already occur. That was our 2020 call on the US debt. You've hit the top. This is peak debt in nominal terms, because I talk about measuring everything in gold ounces, by the way, but we'll come back to that. Let's just talk nominal for now. And then the other tap is you let the fiat debase. So you had quite a bad debt period in terms of debasement. If you look at the performance of TLT, it crashed during 2021, 22 into the lows of 23. And then it's kind of gone sideways. But low down along the lows without making any major moves. We can show that chart in a minute, but let me make the point. But last year, the fiat devalued, dollar was at top of the pops of devaluation of the major currencies. So you actually got the fiat debasement. That was a chance for the other tap to be opened and everybody getting short debt. You know, you had Stanley Druckenmiller and Paul Tudor Jones, very big names that obviously followed. When they came out the tail end of 24 and said, we are very short debt, they, you know, probably taken a year putting their positions on and now they're talking their book. I said, well, now it's going to go sideways for a while and the currency is going to go down. And sure enough, the weakest currency for 2025 of the majors was the dollar. It lost 12.5% to the euro. It lost 6% to the yuan, which is no longer hard pegged. It lost 40% to the ruble. It lost 15% to the, you know, the Czech and the Hungarian florins. You know, hardly bastions of, you know, hard currencies. So there are two taps that you release. So when we just look at the yields, you've got to also take into account how much it's debasing mm-hmm. in currency terms. Some of that pressure is being let out by the currency. You have to have the combined debasement of both interest rate up and the currency performance. So actually the interest rates on the long end didn't change hugely for America. We can take a look at some of those charts. And I'll show you that TLT collapse. But you can see when the TLT is not collapsing, it's usually because the dollar is doing the work. So if we go over here and we have a look at the TLT, this is an iShares 20 years plus ETF. So it's a collection of all the ETFs. This was our technical error when we got short. I'm just going to, there's a lot going on that chart, so I'll just reduce all the noise. This was when we got short up top here. There was an inverted HVF. You then ended up with a head and shoulder. That made its target. But what you might notice is that since the lows of 2024, actually, you haven't gone that much more down on the long end, 20 years plus. Mm-hmm. But you went hugely down from the late end of 2020 to mid 23. So as you were getting to the late end of 24 and Druckenmiller and them were announcing their positions, actually you haven't made much on the short side, but now the dollar had a really bad year. You look at the Dixie measured against the euro mainly 52%, but you can see it's gone down quite a bit during that period. Right now, however, we're actually pivoting into a new phase. We're getting a little bit of dollar strength on account of the events in Iran. You've got to remember there's Middle Eastern pegs. A lot of currencies are Middle Eastern pegged. Bahrain, UAE, Qatar, all of them, you know, the dinar, the dirham, the riyadh, they're all pegged. And that's part of the petrodollar game. So I could see some pegs breaking because their economy is obviously being hollowed out immensely by everybody due to the war and everybody pulling out. I'm surprised, I don't know that we haven't had capital controls brought in, but that might be counterproductive, but I thought they might try it. Maybe some of them have. I don't know, there's been different rumors on there. I'm not sure what's true anymore, but there's certainly a lot of people that's gone out. So there's vulnerabilities on the currencies there. I would expect those pegs to break. We're very bearish the Korean won. It's not a big enough Asian currency to have sufficient contracts for energy provision like China has with Russia. China gets about 23% of its energy from Russia, and it's got a good cooperative agreement, let's just say, with Iran. So I think China does less badly, even though it's in the 60-70% of Asian energy supply comes through the Strait of Hormuz. But I think there could be pressure on Japan. But Japan is much bigger supplies. So I think those currencies get done. Debt markets, the biggest development is actually what's happening on the short end, because more and more governments are moving. They can't afford to pay the interest on the long end and there's not enough demand. They've moved more onto the short end. Let's just bring up Great Britain, for example, Tom, because your question was about yields and the debt markets more than anything. And this is what's happened recently. We're on a monthly, but just bring it down to a weekly. You'll see this move here. This is typically called a falling wedge. Technically, you're getting reduced and lowering volatility. This is a three-year instrument. This is on the short end, ones, twos, and threes. That's how much you moved in short succession. And in fact, I think that Trump funny story that was created invariably comes out and does something when there's bond market stress. You might not remember Liberation Day specifics as well as I do because I was watching for it specifically, but when he had his Liberation Day moments, the bond market was getting disorderly and he quickly came back out and said, no, we've done deals, when he was first saying, I'm not going to cooperate, everyone must pay tariffs, all of us. And then the bond market started to run, the yields. The bond market was crashing, the yields were spiking. And he quickly came out and said, hey, we've done some deals. Now, you just had another example of that with the short end really, really running. So if I just measure this for you, Tom, just on the UK, and it's the same for America. We'll go back to America because I know a lot of your viewers on America, they want to see it. But I wanted to show that it isn't just America that's in this bag. You were up a third, 33.59%. In 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks, less than a month, your yield went up a third. You literally went from a low of around 3.5 to 4.7 in the UK. Let's bring in the US on that one. And you can see a similar type structure, low volatility. Oh, it's all getting so relaxed. Everybody's happy in there. This leads to, and we are the volatility guys. That's why it's called HVF method, volatility funnels. And I'm the H. This is real key move. And again, maybe not quite as extreme as the United Kingdom. I brought them up because they were one of the most extreme. But if you take it from high, from low to high in the 1, 2, 3 weeks. In a 3 week time period, you went up nearly 25%. That's a quarter. Now, he's succeeded in knocking it back down, but I'm asking the question, hold on a minute. If he didn't have any talks with Iran, why hasn't it gone exactly back to where it was? So the bankers have had to come in on the back of his narrative and hold it down because it was getting disorderly. So, it's quite interesting. If you find out that that was a lie, it should return to where it came. But it hasn't done yet. But I suspect in due course it will, because that means the people have come in behind that narrative and are trying to support the bond market, be buyers, encourage other people to be buyers and keep the rate down. So I can see this going further up in due course on the short end, which is reduced. So much more of the financing is being done on the short end because the rates were lower. So if I just compare US 3 year, you know, they were at 3.3 down here 3 weeks ago. You were as low as 3.3. If you go to a 30 year, for example, let's just turn the digits around 3 weeks ago, you'll see that, you know, you're at 4.6. It's a big difference between paying 3.3 and 4.6 in percentage terms. So to me, the long end is almost too far gone, and it's going to be going higher in across the board. And this is part of the debt debasement. But the key point I must add on top of that is, because of the levels of debt, Tom, we are so sensitive to interest rates, we can't get to Volcker rates. Things fall apart a lot sooner. So yes. People who think, yeah, we'll do like Volcker, you know, we'll end up at 17, 18. No, it's long gone, game over before then. And the same goes for oil, because you're getting some people that'll say, we'll go $300, $350 oil, you know, all of that. Sorry, oil goes that high, packaging, delivery, everything will go so extremely high that it'll become unaffordable. Remember, they want to throttle us into there. They didn't shut the full Strait of Hormuz and nothing going through. They are throttling and controlling and doing extra extraction, which is the Marco Polo who had to put up with the Khazars doing ransom and extraction and kidnap when you cross their land, paying tolls. This is the exact same thing. It's just the modern era version of it, and it's inflationary. It pushes the cost up of the final delivered good. So you will get goods, you'll probably get reduced optionality, and you're gonna get much higher cost, much less choice, and thinner volume. So you will also have the volume throttle. So you might get people hoarding, people fighting in supermarkets again, you know, the toilet war, the toilet paper wars, and other interesting things. So in terms of where we're going socially, it's not a good place. But let me hand back to you.
Well, Francis, you know, why I wanted to stay with the US was just for that example. And I wanted to also contrast that with a market and a country that is let's say per capita, probably more in debt, but that's Japan. And to try to understand how and if, let's say, Japan is going to be one of the bellwethers or one of the, let's say, leading debt markets or leading currencies that is going to be showing this stress. You know, of course, the Japanese carry trade has been a massive boon for the world economy, but considering how little energy, domestic energy production they have at a time like this, they're going to be paying like crazy for energy, any energy that they can get. And wrapping that into this idea that they also are one of the largest holders of US debt in the world at $1.2 trillion of treasuries or something like that. When they start to sell because they need money for energy, does that start a cascade in that US debt market as well?
So there's so many good points and interesting points. You've touched on many of the key aspects surrounding that nation. I will go to the high end first, because I think what's always the control. Mm-hmm. So right at the top, just in the way, as I said, they needed stagflation, hence why we ended up with this outcome. Japan never achieved its personal financial independence and sovereignty back after World War II. That means it is at a financial level and scale, and you should check out anyone having doubts on this one and going, no ways, they've got their own sovereign government, they make their own financial decisions. Check our discussion with Professor Werner, who was in Japan and allegedly coined the phrase quantitative easing for the first time, that saw it happen for the first time in Japan, that subsequently saw it come across to the West, once the West followed the model of excess debt and proliferation and thought, hey, let's do fiat debasement. You'll see why I say the things we say, because that's your history and they've done it before, and that's the modus, that's the MO, you know, the modus operandi. So if you accept that, whilst Japan technically needs to do that and should already be divesting, we're talking about this bifurcation and it's everyone for itself, where possession is now 9/10 of the law. So we've gone from a trust system and a just-in-time, you know, total quality management, just-in-time inventory, all of this across the world, everybody working together, everyone working for the greater good that we all benefit from, to this interdependence. We're going back to fiercely independent, nobody trusts anybody. And that's actually descales a lot of things. And that makes it more expensive to live, less efficient, and everybody has to do everything. There's no specialization. And the deglobalization aspect of that is going to be economically bad for everyone. So your question about Japan is, it's going to be buried with its master. The pharaoh used to determine if he's getting old. He was buried with his slaves. They were slaughtered and buried with him. And there's certain Eastern nations that are part of the Western hegemony in a perverse way. And Japan and South Korea are in that category. And the better surviving ones are the ones that actually are not in the Western hegemony. And that's one of the reasons why we say leave the West. There are going to be degrees to this. This is not going to be a hunky-dory period in any country, anywhere. The possibilities of a global depression are much higher than they're being priced in right now. However, like any earthquake, you get zone 1 and you get zone 10. And I'm saying rather be in zone 10, you'll probably survive. Your house might get a few cracks, but it probably won't fall in on you like you would if you're in the epicenter. So inherently, the West is not a good place. I do want to push back slightly on one thing you said, that it was the most indebted per populace. If you take the unfunded liabilities of America, they are the most indebted nation. And they are at, even on its most conservative day, Grok will have it at 450%, but you've had Chicago professors put it at 600%. So the whole Medicaid, welfare, and all of that. Now, Japan has unfunded liabilities too. They go up from around 250 to 350, about 100%. America goes up to 500, 600, from 130. So the truth of the matter is the hegemon, their biggest product is their paper, because they are net importers of goods. They have an artificially high currency, and they send that currency in lieu of debt-based instruments out. And other nations are required buyers. So they inherently overconsume and pass out IOU notes, basically, in their currency. The long run is it benefits them on the high side, but then when the moment of reckoning comes, it tortures them on the downside, because everybody's then at simultaneously starts to question the IOU note's validity, what they'll truly get paid on it. Then you start to get reneging, you have trust issues, and we're in that phase now. So the again, some of the tropes that I like to kill is that America is not the cleanest, dirty shirt in the laundry. It's the dirtiest, largest shirt in the laundry, and it needs a special washer, and it's an additionally big, violent one that clubs that item to death to get all the grime out of it. And that's why the hegemon is on the tallest ladder and falls furthest when it falls. That's not to say it's going to be hunky-dory in Europe, United Kingdom, Australia, and Canada, because they're a part of an allegiance. They've also been synchronized. So we have no nation in the world that's pursued sound money policies. That's why I say they're all getting into the earthquake zone. It's just the question of how close to the epicenter they are. Yeah. China had a property boom. I'm not advocating for going and living in China per se, and communist nations. They were over indebted there. They've got many a sin. So it's not like there's a Narnia that you can escape to, but there are degrees and levels to this. And the worst hit will be America. Right now, however, Europe looks the most aimless and helpless fool, and they are. I would agree with people that say that, but that doesn't mean when the debasement comes, that's the same. The person that was afforded a far larger overdraft is going to see a far bigger move in its relative currency devaluation. And that's just geometry. It's mathematics. So the US gets hit the hardest, and it's going to take down, in this instance, certain allies that it has strong control. So I would question the ability of Japan, going back to your question, to crash the US bond market on the basis of they'll be told, you can stop that selling right now, Buster. Otherwise, you know, something unpleasant happens, like an earthquake, Fukushima, and you get some form of nuclear explosion, subterranean, that sends in a tidal wave. You know, they get taught lessons, the Japanese, and reminded of who runs their show, and probably have been before. So I'm not sure they'll be allowed to. You brought another very good point up that I haven't yet responded to, and that's the funding mechanism that is the carry trade. I also want to highlight that the carry trade is not just a Japan to US thing. It's not only Americans that have borrowed in yen and invested in America T-bills or the stock market. It's also European hedge funds, European institutions, possibly even European, I don't know if the central banks have got involved. Who knows what we'll find out when the tide goes out? I doubt it, but quite possibly they maybe have. But there's also even a Korean won, South Korea carry trade, where yen has been borrowed in Japan, has been invested in Korea. Now, the biggest one is the American carry trade. So I'm not trying to confuse the matter, but I'm just saying that there's levels to this and there's a multitude of it. And Japan has been a funding currency, and those borrowings have been made. And that points to, at some point, when there is a great deleveraging, that flows have to go back to Japan. And that's actually a yen strengthening move, because what you have is people who borrowed in yen have to convert. And this could be what spikes to a degree, depending how deep it is. And I suspect it's a lot deeper than we think. Brent Johnson has popularized, for example, the dollar milkshake theory. And when we used to interview him, we highlighted, what about Japan, though? That was the one weakness that I felt he never addressed fully. And I admire him for the counterintuitive thought. And I think there is certain aspects of that that we're currently seeing potentially play out. We are along the USD Korean won, for example, right now. So you can, when debt collapses, get a bit of a run into the dollar. But if you get it collapsed too far, what you can have is money needs to be returned to Japan. And could it be that when you really get dollar start to get strong, some of that strength gets bled out and the yen does a super spike as a smaller economy on the basis of unwanted money returning violently and having to buy its way back in? Unless, as I say, people stop the clock and everybody's going to renege on their debts. And that's also how I think it is. I don't think we get to see this whole thing break down and everything goes to zero that should go to zero. I think you get the stop the clock moment, and then you get a reset, and then boom, things are reset at different levels. You could get that with gold, for example. You could just get a reval. You could get lots of things that could possibly happen. I'm not an over fan of the reval on gold. I think it works more in favor of other nations that I believe have more gold than America, assuming America even has what it claims to. But there's quite a lot of considerations in all that. And the return of money to Japan would actually push the yen up if we saw a reversing of the carry trade. And it won't necessarily just come from dollars. It could take some of the dollar spike strength, and you could also have the Korean won sell-off as money that's gone into South Korea as a more local capitalist nation that has Samsung and AI that the Japanese might have chased into.
Well, I mean, you bring up such an interesting point, is that, you know, it's so hard to separate out where, you know, let's say isolate one particular move in these currencies, right? This is a global phenomenon. It's a global debt bubble, and there are going to be push and pull forces all over the place, and trying to figure out only one is a lot harder than all of these different things taken together. But as you mentioned, that gold is basically the barometer for this entire debt bubble all across all of these different currencies. And, you know, it's interesting to me to watch the one of the biggest pull downs or drawdowns in gold's price over the last couple of weeks. A lot of people thought, well, gold is supposed to be a safe haven. And then on the other side of it, we are getting this story being told to us that it's liquidity being needed for the entire system. And looking back over the Weimar hyperinflation, I think that's instructive to kind of look at, because gold was very volatile through that time, right?
I'm so glad you brought up what needed to be said next, because we were talking about so much complexity, the yen, and could it be the won, and which currency goes up. For most people watching us, trying to unravel that riddle might be just beyond us all, and we could all be wrong with our prognostications. The key thing to do in debt rebasement, debt and fiat rebasement times, is to preserve capital. And in an environment where the other supposed reserve asset of debt is actually dying and being shown to be overproliferated and devaluing chronically, there is one standout that, simply to reduce the whole conversation to what do you do simply, if you don't want to get too complicated on all of this, you buy gold, and gold will preserve you. And as you highlighted, it's never straight line moves up. I think I underestimated how many people don't have the fortitude for volatile markets. We were fortunate enough to get out of both gold and silver just prior to the first and major slap in the face event that occurred. Silver around 120, we sold at about 111, and I went off to ride my bike, and I even mentioned it on Twitter. And this, so we had no leverage trades on at all, and I have my investment, which is no doubt holding for the full cycle.
That's what I was going to say, is that was from a trading perspective and not from a physical perspective.
Correct. From a physical perspective, nothing's changed for me on anything. And I came back, and there were a lot of angry people. You were the messiah of silver, and you were this, and this has all happened. I said, first of all, from a trading perspective, we were out of that, and we'd done exceedingly well. We're at market's all-time high. We missed the biggest slap in the face. And second of all, from an investment perspective, this is absolutely to be expected. We had a silver target that met 103. We had a 90.5 to 95 interim level on an HVF that we expected we'll have a pullback after we run that. We were in that zone where we'd pass both those levels, the 90.5 to 95. We'd hit 103 target. We were in that last little blow off moment zone, and it was going up incredibly quickly. It made 122, and then it deserved a rest. It needed a rest, and it took a rest. And this is a great opportunity to buy at low prices. And can I also point out, at its lowest ebb when it was around 60, mid-60s, you were paying a $20 premium to get the physical. So the casino price is not even the price that you are getting delivered an ounce to your door of physical. So, you know, to buy it, if that's the price, that's how far it's gone down. Not 66, it's 85. But a lot of people were real angry. Now, in my community, they weren't, because they got the update, they got the full thing the night before, and all of that. So I underestimated how either people were leveraged into this when they shouldn't be and didn't have stop losses, or people who are investors, what I refer to as blue pot, are real angry about this percentage move. And I'm like, you should expect, as part of this major move, this only ends, Tom. And there was a beautiful article about equities. In the 70s, the 68 through to 82, the stagflationary era, equities went sideways. They went up and down, and they actually were well down at certain points, and then back up to level, not much above, for the better part from 68 to 82. That's a long time. It's about a decade and a half. And during that period, we had the gold and silver run. This gold and silver bull market is over when you've had the full correction in all equities, and equities have done so badly for so long that Times Magazine is put out a cover story saying the death of the equity market. That's when you sell your silver and gold, because commodities and everything has taken over, and the actual equities markets have been so unloved that they now are buy. When you get the death of equities on Time Magazine article, you go and you sell your silver and gold, and you then buy an index tracker. Be my guest. That's your moment. You're right. When we traded single digits gold-silver ratio, you've had the full correction. I'll pivot from silver to gold. When that Times Magazine article comes out, I'm getting out of the gold and I'm buying the index tracker, or buying specific stocks that I've got my eye on. And we aren't even close. We barely started in nominal terms a correction on the SPY, the SP 500, and the NASDAQ. So we've got a lot more to come. And you are going to face major surges in upside. Can I also point out that on the options, there's abnormal volume buying gold contracts for expiry this year, December, with 15,000 and 20,000 strike prices. And can I also say, the previous time this happened was in silver, where last year there was abnormal volume buying strikes for February, March this year, with 80 and 85 on silver when silver was 40, and just making higher than the 30s that had been its rev limiter for so long. Well, it traded 122 during that final expiry period. Those guys, insiders, knew something, and it had transpired. What do these guys, if they're not the same guys, know that says 20 and 20K? And by the way, they went deep into the money. They went deep into the money. They didn't just make the money. They went deep into the money. So people that are looking at the gold chart and saying this is terrible, let's have a look at the chart, by the way, because it would be remiss of us to talk about it so much, be a technician, and then not talk about the chart. You've had a hammer here. You've got a bleed up. That's typical of hammers. It's a reversal. So you had a shooting star, which was very negative. That was the slap in the face. You closed there. You traded all the way down. You did an intraday reversal. That was enough to get you three green candles. Then you had second phase. You're getting another hammer now, weekly. We are on Wednesday. We've got a Thursday and a Friday still to do. This one's not locked. But my suspicion is you're going to get another rally. I always say selling comes in threes. So I'm not telling you it's over. I'm telling you, you're going to probably get some a rally because of that hammer, if that hammer locks, which I think it will. And then you're going to get a third sell. But overall, on the daily time frame, let's just catch that. On the daily time frame, I want to draw this and remind everybody that will have seen this before. This is a broadening structure on a bull pole, and it is a continuation. There's your bull pole into the high, and this is your broadening structure.
And while you're drawing that, Francis, I just want to remind people of your point about the New York or the Times article in April of 2019, they had that picture of the dead dinosaur saying, "Is inflation dead?" And yes. Again,
I mean, they're brilliant.
April of 2019.
Yeah. I mean,
perfect timing.
I mean, it was perfect timing. I mean, it literally was the comeback of the great inflation that led to transitory and all the other nonsense that the lying Federal Reserve fed you. So they bled the poison out and that mittle slowly. So you've had selling number one, you've had a rally, a little bit of a broadening structure. You had selling wave number two, and I think you get a rally. You might make it here, you might make it there, but that you get a selling three. You might make it up to here, you might sell back down here, you can come. But in the long run, this capping descending grind line of this megaphone is broken again to the upside. We've got a bit more to go, but it's coming. We've had two of the three sells. Mm-hmm. We get a rally that can take a while. It can be boring and low. I told the community, I suspect that we're going to go up from this hammer, but I don't want to put them in. We don't have a target. We don't know how much. We wait for the bigger moments, which was like when we waited in the UK summer and it was September, everybody back in their desks and gold surged like that out of that continuation pattern. You now just have another bigger continuation pattern. And I'm going to highlight for the silver investors that are doubly hurt, and some of them were really angry about being long silver, that is going to be an even better structure. We prefer it. Because they didn't go as high as gold on the bounce, there's something that's almost better about this. I'm going to just go to log scale. We should be on log scale for a long time frame. So again, nice fat line, bull pole all the way up. What are we getting here, Tom? We're getting a squeeze in the volatility in a downside manner, which is a falling wedge. So for us, you go up a little bit and then you probably have another sell-off, a third sell-off. But this, if we stay in the wedge, this third sell-off will not be as big as the second sell-off and not as violent, which is the steepest sell-off, as the first sell-off. So you'll note, A, the sell-off's momentum is less violent. This came down brutally fast. This is softening. And also, the rally will be weaker, but the sell-off will probably be weaker. And then you break out, possible return move, and you go higher. That doesn't mean you go straight to an all-time high. You might make a localized high, come back down, and then we do a bigger, massive time frame shift. But you will be trading up and trading into the range that was determined at minimum by the previous high and the last low, which may be that, or it may be here, that it sticks out a little bit lower. We don't know. But that's the beginning of a falling wedge. We normally expect three impulses in the falling wedge. Your first one is the most volatile. Then you have that, which is a little bit flatter and broader. And then you go up and over one more time. Then you come out. So when this happens, we'll trade the falling wedge breakout. We'll trade it up into the range. And then we'll see. We might take some profits and we'll see. It doesn't go necessarily straight to all-time highs. This daily time frame could end up setting up something like that, just on a much bigger time frame, and you are in essence somewhere here, you know, on the falling wedge side, somewhere there. That's what could happen next. That's a micro version of what may happen. So you trade the little up leg and then you wait and see what happens, and then you trade the far bigger setup. So good things are coming for me in terms of silver, but I think it's a boring spell right now. So we're in something else. We're short the Korean won, and we're actually long the dollar. If we get the fright and the fear, there may be an oil trade setting up for those that are traders. Again, this is what we do. We just give you a little look. We're not making advice. We cover it in our community. Why we trade low volatility to high volatility expansions is because you get a very tight risk and you get an asymmetric reward when you get it right. There's something happening in the oil market, for example. We suggest that that's going to come and have a little bit of a volatility squeeze. We could see you going up for a third impulse here and coming down and then subsequently breaking out possibly also not too far away. So I think you'll bleed up a little bit with oil. You'll calm down. This was the Trump. We made peace. And now it's quite clear you're probably going to trade off of that. So you could first get that surge. The interesting thing is the dollars tended to go up with oil, even though the oil's priced in the dollar, because it's the fiat currency. It's put pressure on all the other currencies. So you can still get the dollar strength. So that could be oil, gold and silver rally during this period. And then when you break out, you have the dollar and oil going up. And that's when you get your gold and silver third sell-off that I'm awaiting for. So these things tend to dovetail rather nicely. And that's what we focus on, scenario costing. And without forecasting, forecasting means you've ego committed to it and it has to happen. We have multiple scenarios. We let the market tell us which one. And we remain dispassionate and unengaged until it shows us. And then we take the trade that is offered by it in terms of what it does. So that could lead to a little surge. That would take you to 130. I don't see 300. The key thing is you just, because of the sensitivity to interest rates and inflation and the debt markets, oil doesn't have to go to the 150 it did in subprime. We've got way more debt since just before subprime. It just has to stay for a while in the 120s to 135s range, and they throttle Hormuz, and your supply chain gets reduced, and you're paying way more because there's much less supply. The demand price goes up. There's thinner volume behind it. You know, you go in and buy the chocolates. There's only five where there used to be an entire rack. The first five people prepared to pay the much higher price get it. Those that think it's too expensive don't, or come late, they miss out. So you're going to have thinner, less options, and thinner, and you're going to have higher prices. You just keep it sustained at a 125, 130 level, and that's going to do immense damage in terms of where the weakness of the economy is now already. Remember, we're already in stagnation, and now you're going to get a little bit of the inflation. So it's far more sensitive because people don't have the disposable. You've got the disposable incomes are being run down. Real wages are actually going negative. So I'll leave you with that and let you come back at me wherever you wish.
So Francis, just to kind of, I guess, put more of a finality point on this, where do you see gold and silver kind of going to try to accommodate for all of this debt? And is that before a reset type scenario into whatever new type of currency is coming?
Here's the challenges. First of all, I think gold and silver should remain 100% more than ever. Everything that we've seen points to our hyperstagflationary model being uploaded. So everything that we predicted is coming about. And we've done these thumbnails on hyperstagflation. I've been sharing them for a year and a half now already. This is what's coming, you know. So we continue to assess that the debt base collapse is ongoing, and now the short end is starting. That's now was not meant to happen, because that's the final place for central bankers to put debt out. People will take a short-term risk on something not happening that they wouldn't take along. Well, it's now showing that their ability or their desire to do that is even retrenching. So we are coming far closer now to the point of reset. And the only thing that you own is the thing you hold. That's what the world is showing you. That's what Japan is showing you when they want to pay excess and have the oil ship tankers that's going to Europe come to them. They've got to hold it. They need it in their country borders. So trust has gone, and what you don't hold, you don't own. And that applies for you too. So you've got to hold gold. It's your preservation capital. And the casino price that you're now seeing is the reactions short term to liquidity squeezes that are going on in and around dollar derivatives and banking casinos that have set up. And many people have to sell good assets to keep solvent and make margin calls and payments. But that doesn't mean that's the asset price in terms of its value. That means there's four sellers out there that had to move. So for all those people that are bitterly disappointed that gold and silver have had a pullback, really, this is part of the process, and this pullback is a load the truck up opportunity stack like a maniac, and hold it yourself. Hold it yourself or with really close vaulting services that are not related to the banking, for which there's very low counterparty risk. If you do that, at least at an asset level, you will be preserving assets. Those things are going to go up. Here's where the attack vectors of those that do not wish you to retain your wealth will come. Tokenization. So Larry Fink of World Economic Forum and BlackRock fame, is the biggest cheerleader for tokenization. You're hearing certain banks even refer to currency as tokens now in conversation. And they are going to no doubt go about when this current collapse that I'm expecting that's coming down the debt curve duration, it hits us. They'll say, oh, now we all got to do this energy shortfall, how to survive. You mentioned the IEA, the Energy Association, supposedly with their new remits, even numbers on Monday, number plates, and all of these things. This is lockdowns by another decree. We could quite clearly have all. There is abundance. I've always believed there's abundance, and everybody could have housing. Everybody could have a good quality of life. Everybody could be fed. However, if you have an evil cartel that's determined to bring about stagflation and is throttling the supply chain, it doesn't matter that you even have abundance of oil. We have abundance of oil. They're going to make it expensive, and they're going to throttle the supply of it. That means it's in effect scarce, even though it isn't. And that gives a real inflationary force and does real damage to people that don't have wealth. It's going to cause a lot of anger. So remember, they need angry citizens that demand higher taxes on middle class and richer people. So as they own the mainstream media, all the echo stations, everything you read, this whole thing of, oh, shucks, if we have to pay a little more petrol just to remove the nuclear threat of Iran, we'll all do it. You know, they're all repeating the tropes. It's quite clear. It's quite clear that that's going to get more severe. And they're going to sow, you know, race, gender, income class, divide and conquer immensely, and they're going to reduce your freedom of movement, and they're going to push for the end of the ICE engine, maybe, or much lesser use. You might need to have a battery vehicle of some form. You need to be, but my focus is full self-reliance on everything: water, food, energy, and also security, which is a topic in its own. And then at the same time, build network and community.
Yep.
Locally. That's going to support you with people with multiple skills. That should be the focus. Know your policeman, know your local farmer, buy direct, circumvent the supply chain that they've manufactured that you plug into, get out of urban areas, go rural, semi-rural, avoid large, dense areas of low-income people that are likely to be rent-a-mob riots. They're going to be stoked up. They're going to put agitators in there. They're going to get them chasing, stealing your car, burning your car, whatever the case may be. So I do, unfortunately, see martial law, social unrest, and a lot of things coming out of what's likely to happen, because you're going to push breadline. Remember the Arab Spring? Well, Europe's going to get the Arab Spring. Amazingly, the Arab Spring jumped over Saudi Arabia, the very nation that had its name. But it went through Morocco. It obviously went through Egypt. It went through all of them. And that's a breadline thing. That was inflationary and a breadline thing. Then you have a very tinderbox that's easily for agitators to direct anger and to control where it gets directed. And social media and algorithms, they own the matrix to direct the anger. It will be directed, I suspect, probably at white European males that are middle class or high income in middle class areas. But you'll probably get, you know, the woman will be included in that. You'll get cross gender, you'll get cross race and a lot of things in it. And just try avoid being caught up in the mob. Be in a place that's slightly more removed from that. I personally suggest, even if you're in the mountains and the foothills of Montana and only a couple of mates in log cabins nearby you, you ideally need a solution that's outside of the jurisdiction of Western nations. I think the harshest lockdowns and the harshest asset stripping is going to come. I don't think unrealized capital gains are going to be a thing in China, which is a communist country. I think that's a Western and a New Zealand and an Australian and a Canadian thing. I think you look at where all the trial balloons have been floated and they're testing the water, and then suddenly it's an idea whose time has come. That is, when they no longer respect the citizenry, government sees it as supremely powerful and they are removing property rights. To tax you out of an asset that you already own, legally writing tax laws is absolutely amoral when you have reduced the basis of comparison, that is the fiat currency, and that asset has actually not gone up in gold ounces. It's only gone up in a devaluing fiat that they created. It is absolute property rights theft. They are removing it. And it is communism. When you remove private property rights, even if you do it by bite size and decree, attacks here, attacks there over time, just because you do slow water drip therapy torture doesn't mean it's not torture. And this is an asset strip. And then you've got to realize the communism is here, the loss of private assets, and you will then end up a useless eater on UBI and welfare. And once you're there, how many people like that do they need? Go and study the genocide that followed all introductions of communism. Because I've mentioned it's communism. Go check the Armenians and the Donmer. Go check the Bolshevik Revolution. Go check Mao in China. Go check Pol Pot in Cambodia. There's more examples than you can throw darts at a dartboard. So it's deeply concerning. This could be a life-challenging event. So to end on a more positive note, and to thank you for having me on, there's a beautiful life. There's beautiful sunshine. There's great oceans. There's motorcycles to be ridden, Tom. Go and live every day like it's your last, and you will get extended play. It's like the gamification. I gamify life. You know, when you play well, you get extended time. There used to be this game, this car game, extended play. You know, you went fast, you overtook enough cars. We are going to get... live your best life, live healthily, live beautifully, live in the moment. Love, lifestyle is everything. We pursue money not for its end goal. I want to finish on, an image that I'd rather leave everybody with. You can not only survive this thing, you can thrive it. Money is the tool, not the goal. A freedom, magnificent lifestyle, regular, incredible shared experiences with loved ones and friends is the true goal. If you've lived a life with all of those things, and you aspire to continue to maintain that life, we build money for that purpose. We preserve it for that purpose so that we can secure those freedoms and have optionality in reset times. It is a dangerous time at a macro level, but that at your micro local level, you can go and assert for yourself and claim for yourself a beautiful life. And I'm here to help people who have that mentality. That's what the Market Sniper is about. Build wealth, preserve wealth, secure your freedoms and lifestyle. And I'd love to finish on that note.
Well, Francis, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. And I think, our conversation today, as micro as we did get, it also is a great reminder of the important things of trying to understand what's going on in the finance world and then stepping away from it, being able to enjoy life, and having both of those understandings is really key. And I, as always, I can't thank you enough for your time and your perspective on that, Francis.
Absolutely. And if people are motivated to get in touch, we'll follow our content. It's The Market Sniper on YouTube and X. It's The Crypto Sniper on YouTube and X for that aspect. Mm-hmm. And there's links in there to book a call. And, God bless you all. Prepare and love. Don't get cortisoled out. Go and do things. Exercise, breathe, water, cold plunge, ride motorcycles, enjoy the sunshine. It's a beautiful life, as I mentioned. Thanks for having us on, Tom.
Always a pleasure, Francis. And of course, that's themarketsniper.com as well. Francis, thanks so much for your time today.